Hello everyone and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
We must stay alert. We must continue to control the virus and save lives.
Confusion reigns after the British Prime Minister sets about unlocking lockdown. Should Britain stay alert or stay home? I asked Sir David King, the country's former chief scientific advisor, then. With the Supreme Court hearing the biggest presidential immunity case since Watergate, author and investigative reporter David Enrich looks at what the president doesn't want revealed and why. And later.
We're even beginning to hear, you know, what feels like this impending famine at a time when, you know, again, we're just dumping all these really valuable, high nutrient, high flavor food resources in this country.
Could a pandemic that started in an animal market disrupt the global food supply? Hari Srinivasan speaks to environmental journalist Amanda Little. Welcome to the programme, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour, working from home in London, where the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson is trying to ease the lockdown while also mindful that the nation's infection and death rates are the highest in Europe. This is what he told Parliament today.
Our challenge now is to find a way forward that preserves our hard-won gains while easing the burden of the lockdown. And I will be candid with the House, this is a supremely difficult balance to strike. There could be no greater mistake than to jeopardise everything we've striven to achieve by proceeding too far and too fast.
But moving the country from stay at home to stay alert has been derided as vague at best, confusing and contradictory at worst. The only really clear departure seems to be that people can leave their houses for outdoor exercise more than just once a day. And while encouraging those who can do so safely to return to work, the government is still saying work from home. Here's opposition leader Keir Starmer responding to the Prime Minister.
What the country needs at this time is clarity and reassurance. And at the moment, both are in pretty short supply.
Now, there is very real danger still out there. And that is because in countries like Germany, South Korea and China, which have already taken initial steps to reopen, there are new coronavirus clusters and spikes, prompting fears of a second wave of infections. Prime Minister Johnson says his reopening plans are guided by data and public health. But my next guest is concerned that could damage the public trust in science. Sir David King is the UK's former chief scientific advisor, and he's now conducting an alternative panel of experts to provide what he calls clear and transparent best practices. He's joining me now. Welcome to the programme, Sir David. And I guess let me just start by saying, is it fair to say that right now the advice, the sort of new move from the Prime Minister, has been vague and confusing?
Yes, I think the power of good communication is to get your messages out in a way that they can be fully understood. And I think the general consensus on what the Prime Minister said last night and what has been said in Parliament today is that there is a lack of clarity. It seems on the one hand, we are being encouraged to go back to work, and on the other hand, we're being encouraged to stay at home. It is true that stay at home has been removed from the slogan the government has been producing and replaced with stay alert. And I think many of us think that the idea of stay alert is very fuzzy. It's not clear what that means. And so I think I turned to the document that the government produced for Parliament today. It's a good 50 pages long, and I've been working my way through it. And I expected to find the detail that was missing in the Prime Minister's two presentations. And I have to say, the detail is still missing. We see pages saying what we will do is announce the day of going back to work, and then we will, prior to that, announce how we can go back to work. So when we do go back to work, the question is going to be to what extent preventive measures have been put in place in the workplaces with physical distancing, support to enable personal protective behaviors. But we haven't seen any of the detail on these.
So if you haven't seen the detail, and this is a little bit alarming, the fact that you've actually gone through these 50 pages, and what we've seen on the streets, though, are people who have taken the Prime Minister's message to heart. We've seen pictures of full subway cars. The tube seems to be full on many of the areas where people have been, you know, taking pictures and showing them. And also, you know, we've heard from people who are concerned that they say, well, listen, I cannot socially distance, but I'm being encouraged to go back to work. I mean, what do you think is going to be the result of this, of people going out? And do you think that it is premature to lift the stay-at-home directive?
I do think it's premature. I think that we have to proceed with ultra caution. And what my group tomorrow will be publishing is a 30-page report, and I can tell you that each page is full of detail. And we're putting forward 18 recommendations to government. And our recommendations are focused on how we move on from today towards the potential end of the epidemic. But it's setting it out in a form that really says caution has to be used at every step. Now, the government is also saying that, but so far the rules are so obscure. It seemed apparent from the Prime Minister's words yesterday that people were intended to go back to work today, and that's not happening, or it shouldn't be happening. Mm-hmm. It won't happen for quite a period. So I think confusion is the worst possible outcome at this stage.
We've heard. Sorry, it's hard to talk sometimes across these Skypes, but I want to ask you, because I'd like just to, if you could give me a few specific recommendations, because people want to know, should they go back to work? How should they be protected? What is the right time to go back to work? And also, I think your report is fearful that there could be multiple waves of this infection that could actually maybe even hit harder than this first wave.
I think there's several points about this. If we look at what is the most important set of criteria that should be used to get us out of the epidemic, we would face two things. One, minimize the number of deaths, and two, get us out of this as quickly as possible. Now, those two are not incompatible, because if we move too quickly now, we're back to square one. We're back to where we began towards the end of March with the lockdown, and we're simply extending the time period when we can't get back to work. So I think being cautious at every stage of the game is critical. Now, what are we saying? We're saying the government should refocus its ambition to finding every case and tracking and supporting contacts and ensuring an effective community quarantine policy of 14, not 7 days, isolation for all of those contacts. In other words, we need to get back to a routine that we gave up very early on in this epidemic, which is a routine of testing and tracing. Once we have that in place, we're in a better position to manage to lift the lockdown. We need sufficient public health and health system capacities. These have got to be in place to identify, to isolate, to test, treat all cases, and to trace and quarantine cases. All of this has to be put in place, I believe, before we can actually lift lockdown. So what we need to see... Sorry, I'll let you ask your question.
Okay, so you've suggested some of these things which are vital, and the question is, why in these big, rich democracies does, for instance, the United States, Britain, have such a difficulty in getting the number of, or the ability to contact and trace and isolate, and much less the testing, because we know that that's not up to scratch either. But, you know, Richard Haunton, who's the editor of The Lancet, said that the government should have used the month of May to get all of these things that you're talking about up and running before even attempting to lift the lockdown. And he points out to much longer lockdown periods in places like China, for instance, and in other places. So you're saying it's too quick. I'm saying to you then, how long is it going to take to get the contact tracing apps up, to get the testing up, so that you can do it safely?
I think the answer to that depends on the government responding coherently to this problem. We should have, if I can look back to the question you asked me a moment ago, behaved like Greece did in the European Union. Greece acted extremely quickly. They went into lockdown very early on before they had any fatalities, not even one. And the result of this is that in Greece, the total number of deaths is about 150 compared with our 32,000. So what we saw was a period when this disease started going rampant around the country. You will remember Cheltenham horse races running on the 13th of March, which meant that people came from all over the country, a quarter of a million, to watch the races and then went back across all different parts of the country, which is the best possible way to spread a virus. Now, of course, when that happens, what you end up with is a very large number of people being infected with the virus, and this becomes difficult to manage in terms of testing and tracing. Now, so we began mm-hmm. too late, but we've gone mm-hmm. into lockdown. We've brought down the deaths now per day. We've brought down the number of cases. And before we come out of lockdown, yes, I agree with Horton completely, we must see that we have the test and trace capability.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it begs the continued question as to why we don't have that. And I just wonder whether you have some thoughts as to how quickly and, you know, constructively one can get that particular vital piece of ability up and running. But I do also want to ask you this, because are you concerned, for instance, that countries that we have looked at, you've just mentioned Greece, but many people focused on South Korea, people focused on Germany, etc., and they have shown certain spikes with the R rate, certainly in Germany, going up a little bit from under 1 to 1. What are the cautionary tales from there? And are you concerned when you watch other countries that they're in the middle of a full-blown second wave? Or are these little... How do you analyze what's happening in those countries?
Right. Everything in a country where you end up with a second wave means that you have to be prepared for a second wave. And one of our recommendations in some detail is about how to prepare for a second wave. The important thing is, with an epidemic of any kind, is to get ahead of the epidemic at every step you take. To anticipate a second wave is good behavior. Of course, you can hope that it won't happen. But if it does, you immediately put in place the measures that you previously thought through. And that is really, I think, what is missing in Britain, I suspect in the United States as well, is a coherent policy in which everything is brought together. So, for example, PPE, the personal protective equipment for everyone working in hospitals, in healthcare centers, etc., care homes. This was totally inadequate in this country. And I just feel, were we really sending medical staff, doctors, nurses, care workers into work without proper personal protective equipment? And the same goes for testing and tracing. We didn't use the months of February and March to get ourselves up to scratch, to get ready for the epidemic that happened in such a large scale. And again, you have to be prepared for a second wave. There's no guarantee, as you remove the control steps, that you will prevent a second wave. And so we have to be sure that we're ready for it. Now, just in the same way, mm-hmm. we need to be sure that we are ready with the medical remedies that might alleviate the number of deaths that we're having. We need to be working hard on vaccine production. And in this area, I would say only in the last few weeks we've got going on focusing on that. But still, where is the vaccine manufacturing capability in Britain? Still, months on, we don't have the vaccine manufacturing capability here, and we would rely then on importing. And why would we not be at the bottom of the list for people to export to us if we're not manufacturing our own? So I think in every case, it needs thinking right through. And what is interesting, my science advisory group is only 14 people. I include myself, 14 people. We met for 2.5 hours last Monday, and we've been working ever since then on the report that we're putting into the public domain and into government tomorrow morning. The report is intended as advice to government, but as always, when I was chief science advisor, the advice goes into the public domain as well. And what we're really demonstrating here is what I think should have been done all along: transparency in the science advice. We even opened ourselves up to a public viewing of that meeting last Monday, and I think that was a good idea. The purpose of that was actually to show the public how scientists from different disciplines can meet together and decide on a policy and a series of recommendations. It's a very challenging process because there's bound to be disagreements. And that is really what the scientific peer review system looks like. So as we move forward.
So question.
Yes.
Yeah, I have to ask you a question about this. Why is government getting it wrong, as far as you're concerned, because that's what you're describing? And what is the interface between science and politics? Because it is science, but it's also politics. Science advises, but the elected leaders, I guess, decide. Where do you stand on that?
When I was chief scientific advisor, I always emphasized the fact that I was an advisor. And I did let Prime Minister Blair know and Prime Minister Brown that whatever advice I put into them and the cabinet, I would also put into the public domain. And the reason is very simple, because I persuaded him that this was okay on the basis that it would manage to keep the trust of the public on the one hand, which is key, and the trust of the Prime Minister and the Cabinet on the other. It's a difficult road to go down. But the point I always emphasized was this is the advice that I put in, and policymakers have to use their acumen, their ability, their strategic thinking to decide how to act. But I have to say there were very few occasions when the advice wasn't followed. And of course, if you're putting your advice into the public domain, this becomes known. You may know that the Prime Minister's removal of stay at home and replacing it with stay alert as one of the key messages apparently was not even discussed with his chief scientific advisor and chief medical officer. And I do find that really difficult. One of the problems is that when governments make decisions and say they're following the science advice, if the science isn't capable of being independently put into the public domain, how do we know that that is actually what is happening?
Okay, that's a very worrying thing that you just said, because an entire shift of direction, you're saying, was done without talking to the top scientific advisors, people who are, you know, chief scientific advisors like you were.
I found that a bit astonishing. It's been reported in a newspaper today, and it comes from a Whitehall source, but the source isn't named. I think that let me just take you back. Here in Britain, In the late 1900s, approaching 2000, we had the BSE crisis in our livestock in the UK, and particularly in cattle.
Foot and mouth.
And that was I'm talking about BSE. So this was.
Go ahead.
What do you?
Go ahead. We've got 30 seconds left, sir, to David.
All right. So very quickly, That crisis had an investigation afterwards, and a minister had gone on television feeding his daughter a hamburger made of British beef and saying, perfectly safe for human consumption. And at the same time, the scientists were saying, apparently, in his own ministry, saying, CJD is a brain disease that is emerging, we think, from people eating British beef. In other words, BSE can be transferred into human beings as CJD. And so the conclusion of the report, the Phillips Commission report, was the scientists must give their advice both to ministers and the public, so that when a minister says, we're simply following science advice, the public knows whether or not that is the case. So, in other words, this was a severe criticism of what happened at that time.
Well, we'll see. We'll wait to see your published recommendations tomorrow. And in the meantime, Sir David King, thank you very much indeed for joining us tonight. Now, in other news, the former US President Barack Obama has caused some waves this weekend when rare comments of his were leaked. In a call with supporters, he apparently called President Trump's coronavirus response a chaotic disaster. Meantime, the Supreme Court tomorrow takes on the biggest presidential immunity cases since Watergate. They will decide whether President Trump can block congressional and criminal inquiries into his financial practices. As business investigation editor at the New York Times, David Enrich is a leading expert on President Trump's deeply tangled financial history. In his new book, Dark Towers, Enrich exposes the secrets and scandals of the Deutsche Bank, which is the German bank that for many years was Donald Trump's go-to lender. It is now a party in one of these Supreme Court cases. And David Enrich is joining me now. Welcome to the program. Can I first ask you, David, and we know why any Supreme Court matter is very important, but sum up why you think this is so important in the context of where we are now? What will it, in broad brushstrokes, determine?
Well, this basically determines, in broad strokes, whether Donald Trump's financial secrets will remain secret as he seeks re-election later this year. This is the president for his entire time in office, and even before, when he was campaigning, has been a steadfast opponent of having to release almost any information about his personal and business finances. And that he's broken with decades of precedent where people have released their tax returns. And so Deutsche Bank and Trump's accounting firm both are sitting on quite a lot of his very detailed personal financial information. Congress has sought that, and the Trump and his family have sued to block anyone from actually disclosing this information. So the stakes are very high for President Trump. They're also very high from a constitutional standpoint in the U.S., because this is the Trump argument is basically that Congress does not have a legitimate legal role to conduct a very aggressive investigation of the president.
I mean, exactly. I mean, that precedent was established during Watergate, that the president is not above scrutiny or immune from investigation. Just quickly tell us, because obviously the president and his allies and his attorney general have said that, yes, he is immune. He can essentially do anything while he's president. And that is immune while he's president. Nothing can be investigated, certainly in terms of criminality, even if there were allegations of such, until afterwards. This seems to bring in an even bigger sort of radius of that sort of claimed immunity, because it seems to be that they're claiming that even third parties like Deutsche Bank or this and that can't be talked about, can't be challenged. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And it's a very generous and broad interpretation, I think, of presidential immunity and presidential power. And they're, in essence, saying it's not Donald Trump who has been subpoenaed here. It's Deutsche Bank. It's Capital One. It's his accounting firm that's being subpoenaed. And the notion that Congress, as part of its oversight responsibilities and also part of its legislative responsibilities, cannot go to a private party and ask for detailed information about them is a pretty aggressive interpretation. And the argument that Congress is making is that this is core to our role under the U.S. Constitution as providing checks and balances on the executive branch of government. And the argument I think the Trump administration has going for it here is that these subpoenas are very broadly written, and there's reason for them, for Congress to be investigating. But the way the subpoenas are written, it does smack a little bit of an open-ended fishing expedition.
So what do you then, before I get into where your expertise really is here, and it's the specific Deutsche Bank case, what do you predict for these hearings, these cases by the Supreme Court? Where do you think they're going to land?
Well, I'm bad at making predictions. I'm almost always wrong. So with that caveat, and a number of federal courts, in fact, every federal court that has ruled on these cases as they've made their way to the Supreme Court has ruled against the president and his family. And so I think you have to assume that the court will basically by default stick with that precedent. On the other hand, this is a court controlled by conservatives, including two members who were appointed by President Trump. And so I think people are going to be watching this very closely to see how the court balances precedent and kind of established legal theory versus the kind of ideological issues and the political imperative that this is a Republican president.
Okay, so in all your investigation and through the book that you've written, have you come to know that Deutsche Bank knows? Obviously, everybody wants to know about President Trump's tax returns. He broke with precedent. He didn't release them like all the other presidents have and all the other campaigners have. They want to know whether he's actually a multi-billionaire, as he claims. What is the extent of his wealth? What about his business contacts? What about, you know, all these things? What does Deutsche Bank know?
Well, Deutsche Bank knows, I'm tempted to say everything, that would probably be a slight exaggeration, but they know a hell of a lot. And this is, Deutsche Bank for the past two decades has been basically the only mainstream financial institution willing to do business consistently with Trump and his companies. And, you know, they've lent well over $2 billion in total, some $300 million of which is still outstanding. And so over the years, they've collected reams and reams of detailed information about the president and his company and his family finances. And so any information that is out there about where Trump is making his money, who his foreign business partners are, the practices he's been using to collect money, where he's been sending money, all of that stuff is in Deutsche Bank's electronic vaults and is being sought by congressional investigators. But there's, in fact, a lot more than that that's being sought by Congress, and I think that could be very revealing if it becomes public. Congress is seeking not only Trump's records, but also Deutsche Bank's own internal records about its employees' mm-hmm. correspondence mm-hmm. regarding the Trump relationship, any concerns that employees might have had about potentially suspicious activities in the Trump accounts. And so there's a good chance that if there was shady stuff going on in Trump's finances and Trump's companies since basically the late 1990s, there's a good chance that there are clues about that, if not outright evidence of that, in Deutsche Bank's files. And so the stakes here, it's really hard to overstate the stakes for Trump, who has spent, you know, the past 5 years or so fighting very vigorously to keep all this stuff secret. And this represents a real threat to his efforts to keep it under wraps.
So going to those internal records, Deutsche Bank sources for your book, and I think in subsequent conversations, had told you that they did possess portions of Donald Trump's tax returns for several years. Now, yep. They say they don't currently have those returns. What do you make of that?
It boggles my mind. I mean, I've talked to a number of people inside the bank who either currently or previously worked there who literally have seen portions of the tax returns. And, you know, that it's been a couple of years since they've seen them, but they saw them. They were in the bank's possessions. And Deutsche Bank last year in one of these federal court hearings about this litigation said that, no, they don't actually currently have the tax returns. And so, you know, I went back to my sources on this and they said, yes, they were certain that they had them. It's possible they returned them to Trump. It's possible they destroyed them. I haven't gotten a clear answer is the reality. And my best guess is that at some point in the fairly recent past, Deutsche Bank, maybe at Trump's request, returned the tax information to him. So the bank, I take it at face value that the bank does not currently possess Donald Trump's personal tax returns, but it's entirely possible. In fact, I think it's likely that they do have a lot of other tax returns related to the Trump companies, possibly to his family members as well.
So let's get to the heart of the Deutsche Bank-Donald Trump relationship. So we understand that it was a relationship that began somewhere in the late 90s. Donald Trump was a very, you know, well-known celebrity developer, his name stamped on all sorts of buildings all over, certainly on the East Coast and in New York City. And Deutsche Bank, kind of, it was, I'll scratch your back, you scratch mine. Trump was having difficulty getting loans after bankruptcies and defaults. Deutsche Bank wanted to make inroads into the United States and have bigger, bigger clients. It was a little German bank before. And you write the following in Dark Towers. Deutsche had been the only mainstream bank consistently willing to do business with Trump. The bank doled out well over $2 billion in loans to Trump and his companies. Deutsche had become the key force allowing Trump to bounce back from multiple bankruptcies, to recast himself as a successful businessman, and to become a viable candidate for president. So, you know, you described Trump back in 1998 as a casino magnate known for showbiz hijinks and on and off dealings with organized crime figures, and that Wall Street mostly wouldn't go near him. So just describe this incredibly close and mutually beneficial relationship.
Well, as you said, it started in the late 1990s when Trump was desperate for banks to lend him money because he had defaulted on his loans and stiffed his banks. And Deutsche Bank was trying to make a big splashy entrance on Wall Street. And so it needed to find clients who were basically not already adequately served by the mainstream financial world. So Trump fit that description to a T because he was such a default risk. And he was eager to do business with Deutsche Bank because it was willing to look past his many financial sins. And the relationship got underway in the late 1990s. Very soon, hundreds of millions of dollars of loans were going from Deutsche Bank to Trump at a time when no other bank would touch him. And it went very well for a couple of years until Trump, true to form, started defaulting on his loans again. And Deutsche Bank got burned once by Trump. And, you know, the normal practice inside a big, well-established bank when a client defaults on you is you wash your hands of that client. And Deutsche Bank was such a troubled, dysfunctional organization that while the one division that had been burned by Trump decided it would no longer work with him, that message was not properly shared with the rest of the bank. And so the rest of the bank continued throwing money at him. And the pattern kept repeating itself. I mean, he defaulted on numerous loans to Trump on numerous occasions. And even as executives kind of tore out their hair in frustration about how Trump was ripping them off and really embarrassing them in public, the bank kept coming back to him within a year or two, throwing more and more money at him. And so Trump went, thanks to Deutsche Bank, he went from being this kind of washed up, not very successful casino developer in Atlantic City to being one of the kind of premier or certainly highest profile real estate developers on the East Coast and frankly internationally. And that was at a time when Deutsche Bank was really the only bank willing to make large loans to him. And so I think there's a strong argument to be made here that, you know, Deutsche Bank is not what got Trump elected as president, but without Deutsche Bank, it would have been very hard for Trump to make the argument to voters that he was a savvy businessman, that he had navigated all sorts of crises and had managed to kind of come back from near failures over and over again. And, you know, that was true. And it was true in large part because Deutsche Bank over and over again was there to cushion his falls and help him bounce right back.
And you'd think that Donald Trump, he wasn't president then, would be really grateful that he was a bank that would keep lending to him despite all the, but not at all. You write about how in 2008, Trump actually decided to sue Deutsche Bank instead of paying back, or he rather defaulted on loans that they had given to him to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars. Tell me that story.
This is one of my favorite stories, and I've been covering business for a long time now, and I've never come across anything like this. So in 2005, Deutsche Bank made a loan of more than $500 million to Trump to build a big high-rise, a skyscraper in downtown Chicago. And it, that went along fine for a couple of years. And then 2008, the financial crisis comes. The loan is due. Trump gets Deutsche Bank to agree for a six-month extension on the loan. And so it's November 2008. The loan is finally due this time. And Trump just does not want to repay it. And it wasn't that he couldn't. And he was quoted at the time in the media boasting about how much cash he had on hand. So he could have repaid the loan, but he didn't want to. And so he asked his lawyers to go scour the fine print of the loan contracts with the bank to find him an escape hatch. And the lawyers found inside the contracts, there's what's called a force majeure provision, which is act of God. And so it says that in, you know, a crazy, unanticipatable circumstance, like a natural disaster, for example, the loan, portions of the loan are void. And it just so happened that right around that time, the former Federal Reserve Chairman, Alan Greenspan, had described the financial crisis as a credit tsunami. And his lawyers looked at each other and said, well, what is a tsunami if not a natural disaster? And so they presented this idea to Trump that they would use the financial crisis as this kind of contract voiding act of God. Trump loved it. And so they not only stopped paying back the loan, but also sued Deutsche Bank, claiming that the financial crisis invalidated the contract. And then, just as a nice cherry on top, blamed Deutsche Bank for causing that financial crisis and for engaging in predatory lending practices against him, Donald Trump, by seeking to collect the loan. And they sought $3 billion in damages from him, which is, again, I've been covering this stuff for going on two decades now. And this is an act of financial chutzpah that I have never seen before and probably never will see again.
Yeah, obviously, Deutsche Bank, no angels themselves. You talk about how they pushed envelopes to get where they did, and they've been the target of all sorts of internal investigations and the like. But just quickly, do you think there is now bad blood between Trump and his family and Deutsche Bank? And could that, I don't know, play any role in these Supreme Court cases?
No, I think it's actually the opposite. In fact, I think that there's a certain kind of degree of mutually assured destruction here, which is that the Trump administration wields enormous power over Deutsche Bank. It regulates them. It has criminal investigations into them. And Deutsche Bank similarly wields enormous power over Donald Trump, because if all of this information they have finds its way into the public domain, there that is potentially very damaging to Trump. So I think these both sides are kind of locked in each other's embrace, whether they like it or not. And this, so the Supreme Court case could be finally the thing that pries them apart from each other and gets all this information into the public view.
Really, really interesting. And with massive dramatic implications, of course, not just in personal finances, but the idea of checks and balances, accountability, the degree of any president to claim immunity. Thank you so much, David Enrich. It's really interesting stuff. And now, when it comes to where the coronavirus started, there are all sorts of conspiracy theories and accusations out there, but the evidence so far points to a food market in Wuhan, China. And the story has now come full circle, with the spread of COVID-19 sending shockwaves through the whole food industry, from restaurants closing their doors to crops rotting in fields. Our next guest says the global supply chains are in disarray. Amanda Little is author of The Fate of Food, What We'll Eat in a Bigger, Hotter, Smarter World. From the field to the plate, she joins our Hari Srinivasan to talk all about it.
Amanda, you're an author, you're a professor, you've been writing about food for a long time. I want to start with a tweet that I saw from Jose Andres a while back. This was a few weeks ago, and it was so stark. He said, you know, how are both of these things happening at the same time? One was an image of a mountain of potatoes that was essentially rotting because it couldn't get to people who needed it. And then the other picture was of a line 10,000 cars long for food in Texas. What's happening with our supply chain? How are both of these true?
It's extraordinary, right, that at this moment we have a huge oversupply of vegetables, milk, meat, to the point where we're plowing under, fresh produce, we're dumping milk, we're euthanizing animals, and yet there's so much need, there's so much threat of hunger, and I think we're even beginning to hear what feels like this impending famine at a time when, you know, again, we're just dumping all these really valuable, high nutrient, high flavor food resources in this country. What we're beginning to see is what has been true for decades, which is that, you know, our food supply is incredibly complex. The way that it's managed is incredibly archaic. Ideally, this kind of exposure of these realities will help us reform in a really important and long overdue way. You know, we have 15 agencies that deal with food safety alone, right? The FDA, the CDC, the Department of Labor, the USDA, the EPA, all these agencies in some way or another and others are a part of what, you know, maintaining food security and a reliable food supply. So what happens when you have to get, you know, all the players in these agencies communicating, coordinating, trying to figure out, you know, how to partner with the private sector to, you know, get those rotting potatoes to, you know, where they can be consumed. That is, you know, not working. It's very complex. It needs to be, we need innovation and creative solution at this moment. You know, it's both traumatic, but also potentially very generative of solutions.
You know, what you're talking about is reforming a food management system that's from a different era. I mean, you've called it archaic before. How would you fix that?
It is important to remember that, you know, the reason that this is so segmented and sort of diffuse and decentralized, the reason that we don't have a single authority for food safety is in part because, you know, this management system evolved piecemeal, you know, 40, 50 years ago and more. So it's very outdated. It's very out of step with, you know, not only, you know, just the realities of how food is produced in, you know, 2020, but also with the realities of what happens when you have a massive disruption like the pandemic. You know, interestingly, you know, President Trump has put a lot of emphasis on the importance of, you know, having nimble agencies, nimble government, the ability to respond creatively, cut out bureaucratic red tape. We're not seeing any of that right now coming from the Oval Office and from the Ag Secretary, for example. The COVID response plan that they have in place is sort of, let's get back to the way things were and try to kind of restore status quo. What we need to do is think about why, you know, what was normal was dysfunctional and how to reform and adapt. How to, you know, bring efficiencies, move beyond a lot of that sort of bureaucratic, segmentation and dysfunction, build resilience and sustainability into food systems. It's not happening yet. Let's run back to, you know, status quo. And what we're coming to see, as you've pointed out, is that there's so many problems with status quo, with food waste, that we've been wasting 33 to 40% of the food produced in the United States and globally for decades and without much of a solution there. Food safety, nutrition and the quality of our foods, market prices, crop subsidies, a lot of that is now coming into stark relief. How do we manage all these different issues more effectively, with a better sort of coordination among all the different agencies that are managing these issues?
One of your recent columns from Bloomberg was about why the meatpacking industry and these plants have become clusters for the coronavirus 19 to really get into the group of workers that's working there. Explain that for somebody who might not have read it.
At the moment, there are 10,800 or more, actually, COVID-positive cases in meat production facilities. There are about 800 meat processing facilities in this country. Only a portion of those are the very high scale, you know, large scale production facilities. But in those, you know, huge facilities that process in some cases 20,000 hogs a day, for example, you have shoulder to shoulder line work. You know, it's their wet conditions. They're exactly the kind of conditions in which, you know, COVID-19 or any other communicable disease can you know, be transferred among employees. So we've seen that happen. A lot of the towns and cities that house large meat processing facilities have become COVID hotspots. I reported on Smithfield Pork Processing Facility in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and among the 3,700 employees, about a quarter of them, about 1,000 employees, contracted COVID. And it became, of course, you know, a huge public health problem within the company, but also a problem for the hog producers who were supplying the plant. Again, 20,000 hogs coming into this plant every day. The plant shuts down for 2 weeks, and suddenly all of those hog producers have nowhere to put their hogs. There are about 550 independent hog farmers who supply the plant. So the hog farmers are euthanizing their animals, or, you know, coming up on real, you know, crisis and disruption in their own supply. The workers, most of them minimum wage workers, most of them immigrants, are being exposed to, you know, potentially life-threatening disease. And the company is trying to figure out how to keep its revenues online. And by the way, this is again an example of a scenario where there are existing problems and existing challenges that have been around long before COVID. You know, meat workers or, you know, employees in these processing plants face 17 times the injury rate of employees, you know, in other industries, right? You know, these are fast-paced, you know, this is fast-paced work. And so if you're sick or you're burdened or you're under, you know, emotional stress, it's much harder to do that work.
Now, what's the role of the employer here when it comes to, as you point out, a workforce that's very diverse, that might, for whom English might not be a first language, how you know, they're given the information on what their choices are, if they have any, what kinds of precautions they need to be taking? I mean, the CDC looked into this a little bit as well, and they said that sometimes bosses are incentivizing people to show up every day, and then you get a bonus at the end of the month if you don't have any absences. Well, that just creates the absolute wrong incentive if you have somebody who's sick who shouldn't be there.
It's so troubling, honestly. In the case of the Smithfield Sioux Falls plant, exactly that was going on. So there are 40 languages spoken at this plant and 100 dialects spoken at this plant. The workers in the plant had been getting all kinds of information from their families all around the world, that there were, you know, serious COVID threats percolating globally across Asia and Europe in particular, and across the African continent. They had been going to their union leaders, who had then been going to company management and saying, this is a real problem, we want to be prepared for it. And they had been asking for proper PPE, they had been asking for testing, they had been asking for social distancing and breaks for weeks before the plant was actually taken offline. And in fact, the company had offered a bonus of $500 per employee if they didn't call in sick during the month of April. So yeah, the incentive had been on, you know, if you're sick, show up anyway. That had been, you know, the message. At the same time, there had been statements by company representatives and by the governor of South Dakota, Governor Noem, that had said, we think that the disease may be spreading among these workers, not because of conditions at the plant, but because of their living conditions in their home. And because they live in large communities, the implication is that these are unsanitary living conditions. You know, so much of this has been locked away, right? You know, I eat my breakfast sausage or my bacon, and I'm not thinking about, you know, the conditions of the workers. I'm not thinking about, you know, am I paying the true cost for this meat? I'm not thinking about, should we have the volume of affordable meat that we have in our lives? Should we be paying more for that? Should we be considering alternative proteins? A lot of those questions for consumers are becoming very real. And, and again, what are the conditions for the workers who produce this food that we've come to take for granted? That's very important for us all to be, dealing with right now.
The meat industry, for its part, says, hey, listen, if these shutdowns continue, you are going to see shortages on grocery store shelves. And, we have been deemed essential by the government. So is there that likelihood that not only are we going to see a price spike, but a supply shortage now?
Let's be clear that U.S. consumers are not going to be forced to go vegan anytime soon, right? Some of the messages we've been getting from, executives at the major meat produce companies has been, right, this is a food crisis. We're going to see meat vanishing off of shelves. The threats to protein production are real, but meat companies have some reserves of product in cold storage that can temporarily fulfill consumer demand while the plants remain offline. If these production facilities have, recurrence after recurrence of the disease and, waves and waves of shutdowns, that is the real food crisis.
Are those reforms that you'd like to see, are they happening anywhere now? Are there proposals on the table where they could happen?
Representative Rosa DeLauro has introduced a plan, an action plan for food security and food safety. And that is the sort of broadest and most comprehensive plan that I've seen so far emerge. She's looking at, worker safety and ways in which we can not only support the CDC recommendations for safe work environments, but also enforce them. So that plan, the DeLauro plan, action plan, I think is hopeful. It's going to be difficult to get, the kind of bipartisan support that she needs for it. So it's not going to happen in the next 5-10 days, which is, when a lot of important decisions need to be made. But it is a great start for talking about kind of this, broader, holistic, sort of comprehensive look at how do we build more nimble and sustainable food supply chains? And she's got backing from Chef Jose Andres. She's got backing from former Agriculture Secretaries Glickman and Vilsack. And I think there's, a lot of interest. A lot of the ag states, a lot of the states that, depend heavily on agricultural revenue, see what's happening to their producers. And they want, safety and resilience.
Do you think that the way that we farm today makes us more susceptible to the spread of diseases like this or viruses like this? Does that increase the likelihood that this will continue to be worse, especially in places like meatpacking plants?
In the United States, we import more than half of our fruits. I think about 40% of our vegetables, even though we're a huge producer of food ourselves, right? So that creates vulnerability. And whether it's disruption in the supply itself because of climate pressures, for example, or whether it's the distribution systems themselves are taken out by a storm by a global pandemic, how deeply interwoven our food systems are and how vulnerable we are to disruptions elsewhere is becoming very clear. And I want to be clear that it's very important to acknowledge that there are advantages to large-scale food production. I am not saying that we should eliminate industrial farming and that we should, all go back to small and mid-sized farms because it's a lot more affordable. We need not just a sustainable food supply. We need an equitable food supply and an affordable, achievable food supply. And so some very large-scale food production is important because it's cheaper, essentially. But thinking about how we can really invest resources into, efficient local and regional food webs is becoming more and more urgent. and necessary.
Amanda Little of Vanderbilt University and the author of Fate of Food, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And since this interview, Smithfield Foods have announced that it will resume operations in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. The company says they'll comply with CDC guidance and provide workers with PPE, temperature checks, and physical barriers to allow social distancing. And finally, with nearly a billion students out of school around the world right now, many, of course, are missing out on big milestones, including graduation ceremonies. This weekend, former President Barack Obama is giving a virtual commencement address to 74 historically black colleges and universities in the United States. Meantime, an American photographer, Matt Mendelson, captures the uncertainty many students are facing in a new series of stunning portraits from one school in Arlington, Virginia. A tennis player, a swimmer, a lacrosse player, a rower, just to name a few. High schoolers, sad to see their senior years disrupted by lockdown, but still hopeful for a bright future. His series is called Not Forgotten, the Yorktown Seniors of 2020. And that is it for now. Thanks for watching and goodbye from London.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.